Okay, well, let's get started.
Jack, a couple people said they couldn't make it this week.
Okay, well, that's true every week, I suppose.
Yeah, but this week.
Okay. Okay, so anyway, we are doing something, we're moving now to a different part of the book, that's obvious. It's the first part of the book. And so this is a kind of an experiment. It's something I've had in mind for a while, but I've never tried it in terms of this kind of systematic, you know, fairly systematic reading of Love of Knowledge that we've been doing, where at a certain point we stop. The way I think about it is that, you know, we take the analysis of the self, we take the analysis of the different kinds of knowledge and how that plays into this whole dimension of positioning and conditioning and all of that. And then by going back to the first part of the book, we give ourselves the opportunity, I think, to look at our ordinary experience, because what's going on in the first part of the book is very much a review, you might say, an analysis of the ordinary part of the experience. Arthur says the sound isn't very good, and actually I had some complaints on this phone during the week, but let me just try to bring it as close as I can. Is that a little better?
Yeah.
Yes, it is? Okay.
For me it's very difficult to understand because breaks between when you talk.
I see. Well, I don't know what to say about that. If I slow down enough, maybe it will.
It's better.
There's an echo too now.
Okay, well, let me turn my speaker off. That probably can be fixed. Okay.
Yeah.
That's better?
Yeah. No, it's better.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Well, then maybe that was causing the problem. Okay, let's hope we're okay now. So I was starting to say that you know, the invitation here is to look at our ordinary experience, and of course one sign of that is that we are invited here in this chapter to look at the self-image. There's still some echo, so somebody has their speakers on. If they could turn them off, that would be good. Okay. Yes? Okay. We're invited to look at the self-image. But what I want to point to in the beginning, at least, and then I really do want to have people, report on or bring in their own experience, because now's the time in the course where you know, if this has been a kind of a helpful thing, this whole program, then presumably you're going around, you know, in your daily life, and you're asking questions. You're conducting free and open inquiry, you know, and you're looking at the different things that arise. And I'd love to hear something about that. But in the beginning, I want to make a distinction here, and it comes from the very first sentence of the reading. Where, let me get my book a little closer to me. Rinpoche talks about this idea of self-image, and a self-image that elevates fantasy and wishful thinking over what we know to be the case. So, and then he gives an interesting set of examples, basically that we're always telling stories about ourselves that, you know, in which we're the hero. I guess that's the way to say it. You know, and no matter what may be going on in our ordinary lives, in the story that we tell about ourselves, in the end, everybody realizes how wonderful we are, and everybody admires us, and it's that kind of thing. And one of the things that struck me actually in reading this was how much that's a quality that you see in children. Now, it's very hard to generalize across cultures, but in the West, I'm assuming pretty much, you know, children tend to play out these fantasies. And one of the characteristics of our culture seems to be that we just keep right on playing out the same fantasies even as we get older. And so there's this tremendous interest, for instance, in the whole idea of superheroes, you know, people who on the surface seem to be just ordinary people, but then they have this secret identity where they're somehow special. And in the popular culture, at least in America, but I'm pretty sure in Europe also, that's just a very, very popular idea. People seem to like it a lot. And, you know, it made me wonder, if you think about Tibet, for instance, did people, you know, children when they were growing up, I mean, I've always imagined this, I don't really know it, but I've always imagined that when children were growing up, instead of wanting to be Superman, you know, they wanted to be Milarepa, or you know, they wanted to be some great meditator living in a cave, and that was the kind of game they played with each other. Again, I'm just making that up. I'm not really sure it's true, although I have heard Rinpoche say that when he was a child, that's what he wanted to do, was go off and become a great yogi in the mountains. But again, there's this notion that in the West we just kind of hold on to that idea that we have this secret self-image in which nobody realizes how wonderful we are. And
what's wrong with that?
Right. What's wrong with that? Well, it's okay, except, you know, one of the things that I noticed, because I certainly noticed that in myself, is that we're always going to that particular interpretation. You know, in the very beginning, I mean, something happens. It's hard for me to give an example right now. What I'm really trying to say is we constantly are telling this story that, you know, something goes wrong, and instead of kind of facing up to that, we escape into this little fantasy. And that's the idea here of fantasy and wishful thinking. And we say, well, okay, I screwed up here, but in the end, everybody's going to realize how wonderful I am. And part of what goes along with that is, I don't quite understand the reference to Clayton in Aries. Okay. Anyway. Oh, okay. So the self-image has a complement of criticism. I guess Clayton's tuning in with Ari, is that right, Ari? Okay. So yes, there is criticism and self-doubt, and Rinpoche mentions that in the same paragraph. He says, you know, we can be uncritical of ourselves at the same time, but we're critical of ourselves because we have this underlying image. I mean, not only because of that, but because we have this underlying image of if only we could kind of break through the things that we're doing wrong, then everybody would realize, everybody would understand what's really the truth. And the truth is that we are very special. and in a way, that's we don't have to be very subtle. If we realize that that's what's going on, you know, when we talk about the self-image, we may say, well, at a very subtle level, the self is at the center of experience. And even when we're, you know, doing TSK, or if we're meditating, or whatever it is, we try to let go of this central role of the self. But in fact, it continues at a subtle level. But the point that I'm trying to make right now is that it's not subtle at all. It's right up there, right in our face. You know, we're constantly trying to, you know, telling a story about ourselves in which we have this very special quality. Rinpoche gives all these wonderful adjectives, you know, that we're brave and beautiful and successful and wise and compassionate and humanitarian. you know, that we're going to be famous and all of that. Or even, you know, something I've noticed again in myself is, you know, you get to be pretty old and you're still imagining that you're going to accomplish something maybe that you would have had to be doing when you were very young. You know, maybe you say, well, one day I'll be a famous musician, you know, or one day I'll be an athlete, and it's about 20 or 30 years too late, but we don't quite acknowledge that. So that's the fantasy and wish fulfillment side of the case. The other side of it, though, is that underneath that, if you could strip away all the fantasy and the wishful thinking, you know, and you arrived at this level that Rinpoche describes here as saying, you know, what we know to be the case. We say, so the reality of the situation. The reality of the situation is not that I'm wonderful and, you know, have all these great qualities, but I just am who I am. And that's a theme that also comes up in our culture a lot, you know, that we have to learn to accept ourselves. And that's really, seems like it's valuable advice. But the same problem, in a way, comes up at a different level. This is the more subtle version, where when you learn to accept yourself, you're still accepting this whole model of the self at the center of experience, taking a position. And TSK wants to go farther than that, right? TSK wants to encourage us to settle into our experience. You know, we have to be able to accept ourselves in the sense that we can't escape off into some other story. If we're doing it at that level, if we're at this level of fantasy and wish fulfillment, then we can't even begin to do any kind of inquiry, because it's more important to us to keep that fantasy going. You know, all of our energy goes into maintaining that, and that's the way we kind of, I'm going to say it in very strong terms now, but that's the way we make it through the day. You know, whatever else is going on, we're busy telling this story of saying, well, yeah, it looks like that, but the truth is, and then we tell our little fantasy. You know, this is who I really am. If only people knew, or if only I could kind of get past my own, whatever it is, confusion or doubt or agitation, then it would become clear who I really am. If we go to that level, then we can never even begin to do inquiry, because our energy is going in a different direction. So first we have to get rid of that level, and what I'm suggesting is then there's this second level, which is the level of what we know to be true, as Rinpoche says, what we know to be the case, but that level is also just a story, and we need to be able to question that one. But at least we have to start there. We have to be able to strip away all the really crazy stuff, which is not, you know, crazy is maybe not the right way to say it. We need to be able to penetrate our tendency to go towards fantasy and wish fulfillment and go towards what's more real. We need to be able to accept ourselves. But that's not the end. That's the beginning. And that's really the point I'm trying to make. When we can accept ourselves for who we are, then we're ready to really inhabit our story, you know, inhabit the positions that we have and look at the conditioning that we take for granted and really ask the kinds of questions, do the kind of inquiry that TSK is asking us to do. Was there a question there? No? I thought I heard somebody try to break into my stream. Okay. Okay. Maybe it's that I think there's a little echo. I think that's what somebody still has speakers on, and I'm hearing my own voice. Okay. The other side of this then is, or maybe to go a little further with that, at the bottom of page 61, Rinpoche talks about being obstinate about our fallibility, right? And what he's really making the point here, we don't realize how we're causing problems for ourselves. We don't realize how we're making mistakes, either collectively or individually, as he says. We continue to believe that if we do things the way we've always been doing them, we won't get the same results, we'll get better results, which is a funny thing to believe. But it's part of this position, part of this condition, part of this conditioning that we take. We don't see any other choices when we go in that direction. So that is, it's only one example, but it's an example that I think helps point out again how we're just committed to our story. So we need to be willing to face up to the truth of our situation, and then on that basis, really inquire into that situation. So we go to the story, we go to our sense of who we are, not who we wish we were, not who we like to believe we are, not who we kind of tell ourselves in the back of our minds that we are, but really the kind of reality of our situation. And then explore that. And that's the practice. And I really wanted to kind of get clear about that. And one thing I noticed that I thought maybe I'd ask people if you've had a similar experience, those of you who are calling in and can speak up. There was especially one day this week, I woke up and I noticed that there was this little dialogue that I was having with myself. And of course people talk about this all the time. They talk about how there's this voice going on in your head, you know, that's always telling stories. And I've always had a little trouble with that. I mean, that doesn't seem to be my experience, say, in meditation. The way that thoughts come up in meditation for me, is different from that. But what I was struck by was that early in the morning, there's a certain amount of work you have to do to get your act together. It's kind of like putting on makeup, I guess, or you know, getting dressed. And it just seemed to me that my mind was really very busy first thing in the morning, telling these telling stories, and the content of the story didn't matter so much, but just in the course of all that muttering, all that mumbling that was going on in my mind, my whole basic underlying story was getting set up. And I hadn't really ever quite noticed it that way, so I was curious to see if other people, does that experience or that description, does that make sense for anybody else?
I'm insane in the morning, and I have to go outside, and I have to meditate in nature, and I have certain readings I have to do to quiet my mind, and so that I can even begin to be sane. Seriously.
Yeah. Well, okay. If you don't mind, can you say something about that being insane? What that means?
I'm an alcoholic,
okay,
and a drug addict, and I've been in recovery for 4 years now. I've got a little over 4 years. And so, you know, I took a big ego, you know, kicking when I did the steps, but every morning I have to turn me over because my mind is just crazy. I mean, I relate to what you say, busy, yeah, it's way busy, way too busy. It's thinking this, thinking that, thinking this, thinking that. And just out of everywhere. And so I had to just, whoa, stop everything, and I really had to meditate. And I had to read some things about the earth and about, you know, nature, because that's where I get my healing, is from nature.
Okay.
And that kind of puts me in that place where I'm okay. Mm-hmm. I'm better than okay.
Okay, well, that's very interesting. So a kind of healing yourself from yourself, and that's really a, almost like a ritual that you have to go through every day. That's
not every morning.
Every morning, okay. So I wasn't
and
exactly.
Sometimes I have to stop myself through the day.
Uh-huh.
And pause.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting, and that you know that I mean, it sounds like that's something you've learned, you know, through hard experience that you've had to do
yes.
that.
Yes.
And
but DSA has really helped me in the sense that it has helped me really take it further. It's like a furthering of the 12 steps of looking at myself and trying to, you know, get out of myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Well, that's interesting. That's way, you know, more central, more meaningful, I guess, than what I was trying to describe, because I was describing something that was just kind of going on in the background. But anybody else want to say anything along those lines? You know, what I guess the question then, the general question is, what happens first thing in the morning? You know, how do things get set up? What do, is there something you need to do, as Tina was saying, or is there something that just seems to happen almost automatically? You know, how do we put our world back together in the morning? Or you know, maybe that's not your experience. But anybody else want to say anything about that?
Yes, I'll say something. Can you hear me, Jack?
Yes, very well.
You know, the lady who spoke just now, it echoes my experience in the sense that my ego, or the part of me that is very on automatic pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't get a chance to do my ritual, which it is similar in the sense I do some, I don't know, lighting the candle and doing some refuge stuff, steps and reading of some mantra or something to kind of bring, I heard it once you said it, this was the best, put me among the things happening, not that I'm creating my world,
mm-hmm.
but it's not very conscious. It all happens very subtly and unconsciously. As I do take the refuge, as I read Long Chapter and saying how the nature of things are, it's like my glasses changes, my lenses changes, so whatever I perceive becomes completely different. And it's very subtle, but if I don't do that, and there are, let's say, 10, 15 days out of the year, I don't get to do it because I'm in a hurry, whatever, that autopilot that I'm on, it takes me in a very different direction, and it's almost like I'm lost.
Almost what?
That I am lost.
You're lost. Okay.
Lost, meaning there is no meaning,
mm-hmm.
or the meaning is very limited and
mm-hmm.
small or silly or sometimes stupid at the end. You know, let's say at the end of the day when and I haven't done it and I look at my steps, a review of the day is like, I'm not so proud of how the day ended or how my time was wasted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it is an echo of what she said.
Mm-hmm.
It's like reconvening or readjusting the path that I would take or I would be guided.
Mm-hmm.
My experience echoes that.
Yeah. No, that's very interesting. So we're talking about a number of different levels. You know, one level is this tendency towards fantasy and wishful thinking and you know, what I would really think of as a kind of an escape from what's going on. And then another level, which Rinpoche describes in the book, is, you know, what I have described, I guess, as the kind of realistic level, where you really do just settle into your own experience as a self. But what the two of you have described is a third, maybe not level, but something different where there's a you know, fairly conscious effort to, I don't know what a good way to say it is, to reinforce a particular story, which is one that has really positive consequences. And when I call it a story, you know, I'm not saying that it's phony, that it's false. You know, this,
right.
The wishful thinking level, that may be kind of false and phony, and that's why it's important to be able to break through that, to cut through that. But then you can get to a level that's very honest. Yeah, yes.
Hayward.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that perhaps the ritual shifts the state.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It opens the state.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
That makes sense. That makes sense to me. And so you could say, you know, let's talk about it in terms of TSK or in terms of the practice or the kind of fundamental approach that we've been emphasizing, and that is moving towards this free and open inquiry, this ability to inhabit our situation and engage in knowledge from within the situation. You would like to be able to create a condition, a circumstance in which that's possible, right? And that is also a story. You know, that is also it's a kind of a truth that we inhabit. I mean, the fact that we can do TSK inquiry, let's say, that's also a condition. It's a particular way we make sense out of our experience to say, okay, I'm going to do this kind of inquiry. But then once you've set that up, then you really do have the possibility for activating a different kind of knowledge, which is not that story-centered knowledge. So, you know, there one way to say that, I suppose, is that there are good stories and bad stories, or a better way is that there are stories that are helpful in terms of inquiry. And, you know, if you find yourself, if you get started on the day in a way in which is either going to support fantasy and wish fulfillment, which is what Rinpoche emphasizes here, or maybe is going to support a sense of yourself as being confused and lost and worried. Or, you know, you could come up with a number of different examples. So maybe it's going to, if you're going to get started on a story in which you're under stress and tension and there's more going on than you can handle, there's all these different possibilities. Let me add one more, kind of in terms of what people have been saying. Maybe a story in which you feel you need some sort of special situation or special stimulus, or you have some need that has to be satisfied before you can really cope. There are all those different stories, and if those are the stories that you're operating with, you're not going to be able to do inquiry. You know, you're not going to be able to develop the kind of more fundamental knowing that's not based on conditioning, which is what TSK is all about. So then there's this other story, you know, that you can really develop. Hayward, I know you think about this in terms of states, and that seems to me to be very appropriate. You say you need to, I don't know about need to, but there is a state, there is a way of being in which it's possible to activate a different kind of knowing. It's not yet that knowing, but it's a kind of a precondition. Now, having said that, you know, I think I also have to say that the condition, I mean, if in fact you have access to that other way of knowing, then it turns out that it's available in any situation. But it also turns out that you don't put yourself in certain situations, you know? You don't live a way of life that forces you in the direction of fantasy or forces you in the direction of confusion or whatever it is. The ability to question, the ability to be aware and awake and alive within your situation supports a way of, you know, a kind of a conditioning or a kind of a position that reinforces our ability to know. So it's a circle, you know, it's as most of these things are. If you go in that direction, then you find yourself able to go further in that direction. And if you turn away from that, if you get lost in your fantasies or you get lost in your neediness, you're stuck, you know, until you find some way out, until something wakes you up. And it might be just a recognition that things can't go on the way they are, you know, that the way your life is unfolding is not not only not positive, but is destructive. So that may be one way of doing it. So, you know, Rinpoche, at the end of this short reading that we had, says, let's see, right at the very end, actually, the last sentence. I started with the first sentence and I'm ending with the last sentence. I guess that's good. He says, once we've made the commitment to knowledge, we may discover that our conditioning, though comprehensive, does not foreclose knowledge. And that's really the point I'm trying to make. You have to make that commitment to knowledge. And some of the examples that people gave, you know, that may not be the most natural way to describe it, but what you're describing, it seems to me, is making a commitment to knowledge and turning away from a commitment to destructive ways of being or agitating ways of being. So once you make that commitment, once you take that position, then within the position or within the conditioning, knowledge is available. And I think that's what Rinpoche means when he says, you know, our conditioning does not foreclose knowledge. Because within the conditioning, there's the knowledge of the conditioning in operation. It's available. And the conditioning itself is a kind of a knowledge. It's a way of structuring and formulating knowledge. But in order to recognize that, there's this sense, some conditioning is better than other conditioning. There must be a better way to say that, but that's kind of, I think, where we're going to end it right now. Maybe you can find better ways to say it for yourself. But of course, the point is not to say it. The point is to do that exploration, is to ask those kinds of questions. So, that's where we are for today. The reading for next week it starts with the last chapter of paragraph 9, the last paragraph of chapter 9. And looking at it now, I think I maybe was being a little bit too fancy in doing that. But it's fine. Just, you know, it's the last paragraph of chapter 9 and then the whole of chapter 10. And I introduced that last chapter, that last paragraph, for reasons that I'll talk about in the orientation. So that's it for today.
Thank you very much, Jack.
Okay.
Thank you.